All right, we're beginning here on the top of Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph, four lines from the top. The Gemara here is continuing to bring drashot from the pasuk Midvar Sheker Tirchak, and has different manifestations of this, especially in the context of a court situation in which the situation or the case is not a case of direct Sheker. So it's not don't speak Sheker, but rather Midvar Sheker Tirchak. It's something that appears like Sheker. It's something that allows Sheker to take place. So these are derivatives of sheker, and that's how the Gemara is darshaning me dvar sheker tirchak. Not literal sheker, but things that will precipitate or things that will generate problems of possible sheker, and therefore tirchak, you have to stay away from them. So the last one we left off with was din mirumeh, if the judge knows for certain that their case is a problematic case. And the one before that, where you have a witness or a judge that is joined together with a gazlan, all of these are areas where we say you should distance yourself from it, walk away from it, because you don't want to be a partner to sheker, to a possible outcome that is incorrect. So now, minayin tamid sheyoshev lifnei rabo, v'roez chut ani. How do I know that you have a student who's sitting before the Rebbe? Seems to be the practice in their day in the courts that the students were present in the court. Then during the deliberations or in the back and forth, the Rebbe used to speak to the students. He used to ask them what they were thinking, or students would speak up and say, wait, what do you think about this? Have you thought about that? First of all, that's how they learn, but it's also how the Rebbe gets prompted to remember things and to think about things. And we know that there are times where Rav Nachman tells Rav, don't ask me the question now, I'll speak to you about it after the case. So we've seen those types of interactions between them. So here you have a Talmid that's sitting before his Rebbe, v'ro'ez chut la'ani, v'chov la'ashir. And he sees something that is beneficial to the side of the poor person and to the detriment of the wealthier individual. Obviously, this is in opposition to what his Rebbe is seeing. Minayin shelo yishtok. How do we know that the Talmid should not remain silent in this case? Talmud Lomar, Midvar Sheker, Tirchak. You have to stay away from falsehoods. And also here, if he doesn't speak up, then the case is going to turn out the wrong way because his Rebbe, the judge, is favoring the rich person. When the Talmud sees that there's a benefit or something that will help out the Ani. Now, even though, as the Balei Tosafot point out, that in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Gemara actually quoted a different pasuk, which is over there, Lo Taguru Mipnei Ish. Don't be afraid from anyone. And that means that even the Talmud should speak up in front of his Rebbe when there's going to be a mistake that's made. But also it says that's Derech HaShas, that in some places it'll bring it from one pasuk, in other places it'll bring it from another pasuk, because these aren't limudim in the sense of halachic normative limudim. They're more along the lines of agadic limudim. That doesn't mean that they're not binding, it's just that they're more like the lines of an asmachta, and therefore sometimes they'll bring it from Dvar Sheker Tirchak, sometimes they'll bring it from Lo Taguru Mipnei Ish. The only interesting thing over here is that the Taz quotes in the name of the Maharal that this din only applies unidirectionally. That's only when the Talmid sees a benefit to the Ani. But if it's the other way around, where the Rebbe is favoring the Ani to the Ashir's detriment, and the Talmid sees something to the benefit of the Ashir, that the Talmid does not have to speak up. That is the way that the Taz quotes the Maharal. Others take issue with this. Yeah. The Maharal suggests that's because Otetar Dal Berivo is only a requirement on the judge himself, not on the other parties that are present, as opposed to Midvar Sheker or Lo Taguru Mipnei Ish. When it comes to the favoring of the wealthier individual, that's the natural way we would have assumed things would have gone. So therefore, the Talmid should come to the defense of the Ani. But on the other hand, when it's the other way around, so then you don't need to come to the defense of the rich person, because that would be the natural tendency anyway. That's what the Taz quotes the Maharal, but there are others, like the Maharshal, that think there should be no difference, which is Midvar Sheker Tirchak, like you're saying, that you want the truth, and the truth doesn't matter which way it's going. Minayin etamid shred rabo shito ebedin. He sees his Rebbe is going the wrong way and going to paskin incorrectly. Shalo yomar amtimlo achi yigmerena. Let me wait until he reaches the verdict. Vesetrena ve'evnena mishali. I'll then undermine it. And then I will rebuild it of my own, kedei shikra din al shemi. Because then the psak will be in my name, or the conclusion will be in my name. Tamilomar midvar sheker tirchak. Stay away from falsehoods. So even though here his intent in the end is to correct the mistake and not to allow it happen, but he's willing for his own benefit to let someone else make a mistake or do the wrong thing. And that's what it means. It means Dvar Sheker Tirchak. Don't allow Sheker to take place, just because then you will benefit personally, because then it will be in your name instead of your Rebbe's name. Correct your Rebbe and make sure that he comes to the right conclusion. Don't try to get the credit for yourself. Minayne tamid, shamar lo rabo, yudea ta bi, shim notnim li mea maneh, eni mevadeh. So Rebbe says to the Talmud, you know me, we've been together for many years. You know that I would never lie. I would never make up anything. And if they gave me 100 maneh, then I would not lie about it. I would say that I have the money or I don't have the money. I'm not going to tell an untruth. So maneh yishli etzel ploni, vein li alav ela eid echad. I lent money to a certain individual, and I only have one witness to that fact. Minayin shalit starei fimo. How do I know that the Talmud shouldn't join this aid? And then you have 2 edim to extract the money from this individual. Talmud lomar, midvar sheker tirchak. Where it says, hai midvar sheker tirchak nafka. That you learn now from midvar sheker. Ha vadai shkurei kamishaker. There he's definitely lying. He's asking his Talmud to be basically a false witness in order to extract the money that he truthfully is owned. So he is saying that the ends justify the means, which is, you know that I only tell the truth. You know that the money belongs to me. I want you to basically lie as a witness in order that I get my money back. So the Gemara says, that's not midvar sheker, tirchak, that's sheker. So you see, by the way, by that distinction, what the Gemara means in these other cases. The other cases, it's not outright sheker. It is something that will either lead to sheker, it's something that has appearances of sheker, or things where there will be a falsehood, even though it will be corrected later. But here, it's outright sheker. Rachman Amar, lo taneh b'reacha, ein sheker. And the Torah says, not allowed to be a false witness, you're not allowed to bear false testimony. Ella, kegon damar lei, vadai chad tzad da'idli. I have one aid. Beta ata, kum hatam, velo teima, velo mide. All I want you to do is show up in court and stand by that other witness. Ta'alo mafkak mipumach shikra. You don't have to say a single falsehood. Afilo achi asur. Even so, that's problematic. Mishum shenemar, idvar sheker tirchak. What he's trying to do is give the appearance of having 2 edim. Even though he has 1 aid, and the other person's not going to testify, the Talmud's not going to testify. But he just shows up as if he's standing behind the first aid to come and testify. That will spook the debtor, and the debtor will think he has 2 edim, and he's about to be caught in this lie about the fact that he owes the money. So then he'll admit to it. So what he wants to do is create the appearance of having 2 edim rather than 1 aid, even though, again, he's not asking him to lie. It's just a matter of appearances. But that's still midvar sheker tirchak, because you're presenting an image, or you're making a statement through, not words, but through your presence, falsehood, that is going to convince someone of something that is not true. Minayin enoshe b'chaviro maneh, so yomar, person is a creditor to another party for 100 zuz. Et enu b'mataim, I'm going to actually claim 200. I know he only owes me 100, but I'm going to claim 200. Kedei shiodeli b'maneh, because then I know he'll admit to the 100. B'itchayev li'shvua, and then b'chayav shvua modeh b'miksat. Okay, but he knows he's going to admit to it. So why does he care that he gets a shvua modeh b'miksat? That will help me, because then I can do gilgul shvua, and I can force him to take a shvua on other matters where we have an altercation that I can't force him. For instance, Rashi says we have a issue over karka. You know, einish bayim ala karka. There's no shvuot that are taken on karka. So now, if you want to create a situation or a scenario where you could force him to take a shvua on the karka issue, what you'll do is you'll create a scenario of modav and miksat. He'll have to take the shvua. Once you have him taking a shvua, then you will add in these other items. Talmud lomar, midvar sheker, tirchak. Again here, he's not trying to do anything in a sense that's false. He's not trying to really take 200 zuz from him. He's only trying to take 100. But he's using the false claim to generate a need for a shvua, and through that create a gilgul shvua that will allow him to take force a shvua in another instance. And again, that's not untruthful. He wants to know the truth about that other situation. So none of this is really to extract money that's not owed to him, but he really wants to get a shvua out of this individual. We don't allow you to do that because you're using false pretenses to get there. Person owes his friend 100, but the creditor is making a claim for 200. I'm going to deny the whole thing. I'm going to be a kofer bakol. And then I'll admit to him after Beitin that I really owe him the money. because I don't want to be chayav shvav moda b'miksat. V'lo yigalgel alai shvav mimakom acher. So he doesn't force me to take a shvav from somewhere else. This is from the debtor's side. He doesn't want to be trapped into having to have a gilgul shvav. Now the Balei Tosafot asks over here, what's the issue? Why does he care if there's going to be a gilgul shvav? This individual wants to tell the truth. We see that. He wants to admit the fact that he owes the 100. Why is he worried about a gilgul shvua? So Balei Tosafot is suggest over here, v'yesh lomar kegon shein lo kedei lifroach kol ma sheyigalgel alav. He doesn't have sufficient funds to have to pay back everything that is brought upon him. I mean that he has enough to pay back this 100 zuz that he owes, but if there's a gilgul shvua, he doesn't have enough money to cover the other claim. So he doesn't want to have a gilgul shvua because that'll bring everything to the forefront and then force him to pay, and he won't have the means by which to pay, and then they'll liquidate his karka in order to force payment. So he wants to avoid the gilgul shvua so that he doesn't get trapped in that. So what he'll do is deny it, be a kofer bakol, and then after he's a kofer bakol, he'll walk out of Beit Din and say, listen, I owe you the 100, here's the 100 that I owe you, and that way he won't be stealing, but he also won't be entrapped in the gilgul shvua. Talmud Omar midvar sheker tirchak. You have to stay away from falsehoods. So even though, again, he's not trying to lie, he's not trying to get out of the payment, he's simply trying to get out of a bind, nevertheless, lying is not the means by which you can do that. Minayin l'shlosha shenoshim maneh be'echad. I already know if three people actually are creditors to a single individual. Shlo echad bal din, u'shnayim edin. That one of them should be a litigant, and the other two will be witnesses. Kedei sheyotzi maneh v'yachloku. In order that they will extract the money and then split it between them. Because they're not showing their bias here. They are also litigants in the case. They are going to be beneficiaries of the money that's given, and they have a conflict of interest. The fact that they don't disclose that, even though they're telling the truth, and they are telling about a witnessing of an event, which is true, nevertheless, you can't do that because you're not disclosing your biases in this situation. Now, the truth is, some point out, that the case here is only because vayechloku. Because they are going to be beneficiaries of the money, that means that they're really colluding in the case. That means if it isn't vayach loko, if they're not going to split it, then they really would be independent parties because they're going to get no benefit from the money that's extracted over here. And in that case, they might be valid witnesses because they're not nogea b'davar anymore. Minayin l'shnayim shebaludin, echad avush smartutin, echad avush itztalit bat me'amaneh. Two people show up in court. One of them is wearing rags, and the other one is wearing a beautiful cloak that is worth mea maneh, 100 times 100, 10,000 zuz, which is an extremely expensive cloak. Shomrim lo, we say to the individual with that cloak on, lavush kemoto, either dress like him, or he'll be shua kemotcha, or give him clothing like you. Tamal omar midvar sheker tirchak, you have to stay away from sheker. As Rashi notes over here, we're worried again against bias in the case, because the way people are dressed does affect the outcome of the case, and that is true even into the modern day. If you have a person clean-cut that comes into court and speaks versus someone who is disheveled and erect that comes into court, the juries or even the judges will be biased against the individual who's in tatters or looks like they're unkempt or looks like they aren't put together. So the same thing is true here. Now, there isn't a demand. This isn't some sort of communistic idea that everybody's got to wear the same clothing and got to show up in court in the exact same uniform, otherwise you can't be in court. But rather, it has to do with disparity. You can't have such a large disparity between the two balei dinim. If one guy comes in with a nice shirt and the other guy comes in with a nice shirt, but it's not as nice as the other guy's shirt, that's fine. They're both dressed nicely. They're both presenting themselves in a nice manner. The problem here is the contrast between the individual coming in rags and the other individual coming in what's like a clothing of royalty. That disparity is too big, and that leads to biases. So what we want over here is for you to flatten out those disparities or those biases. Now, again, that you have to be exactly alike, but you have to be close enough where the clothing or the presentation of the individual is not going to influence the case, or the other way around that we've seen until now, that the nistatmu, tanotav, that the other individual won't feel that he can't speak up or he can't speak in the court and get a fair trial because of the favoritism towards the other one or the partiality towards the other one. When litigants used to come before Rava bar Ravuna, shlofu puz mai kaichu, take off your socks or your slippers, v'choto ledina, and then gapir for the din, seems to be that they were wearing fancier shoes or fancier socks, the type of things that maybe someone of royalty would wear. And he again wanted to take away that disparity, so he told them to remove those socks, slippers, before they came into the courtroom so that everybody would be on the same footing. How do you know that you're not allowed to listen to one of the litigants before the other litigant shows up in court? You have to stay away from falsehoods. And that is because when a person testifies without the other party present, they are more likely to lie. They have less inhibition about what they're saying because the other party's not there to deny. Person who knows the truth, they're a little more scared to speak in front of. So here if they come individually and speak with a judge before the other party's there, they're going to then be more free in speaking and also more likely to lie. So from that is, midvar sheker tirchak, we don't want that type of bias, and therefore we want both litigants to be present when they're speaking to the judge. Minayin the baldin shelo yatim dvarav ledayan kodem shivo baldin chavero. How do we know that a person should not flavor up his words or explain himself to the judge before his counterparty comes? The judge, once he's heard the situation, then that embeds within him a certain belief or certain thoughts about the case. So then the other party who comes is going to have to undo the damage done by the first party, and that's very hard for him. He's at a disadvantage now. So once again here, you have the same problem, which is that if he is given the ability to explain himself beforehand, if he's given the ability to explain the situation, then again, the judge is going to be biased towards this individual. And again, the inhibitions for this individual to speak are also problematic. Rav Gana Matne, he learns it not from Midvar Sheker Tirchak, but rather from Lo Tisa Shema Shav, Lo Tasi. Don't just read it as Lo Tisa, but also Lo Tasi. So as Rashi notes over here, Lo Tisa Shema Shav is Azarala Mekabel. That's a restriction against the judge to accept false testimony or to allow false testimony to be presented. And then Lo Tasi is Azarala Baldin, to the litigant, that he shouldn't be the one presenting that false impression or giving the feeling what he's saying is true, even though it's totally false. Basher lo tov asa betoch amav. So here we quote from Yechezkel. It's an individual who's not doing the right thing, not making the right decisions. Rav Amar zeb haba beharsha'ah. This is someone who comes to court on behalf of another with the power of attorney. Basically, he becomes the representative of the party in court, or the lawyer for the individual in court. That's a person who, asher lo tov asa, he's not doing the right thing. Now, there are different reasons brought over here for the problem. One of the issues is that mitaber al riv shelo lo. He's getting involved in an altercation that's not his. These two parties have a quarrel, have an altercation. Now he's entering the fray, and he's going to represent or make arguments on behalf of one of the parties. So that means he's just generating or engendering more altercations or difficulties or quarrels between people because he's entering to a fray that has nothing to do with him. So that's how Rashi says. Number two, b'shema rishon noach lo, b'noach lipshara. The second thing is about reconciliation or settling between the parties. And that is because the Baal Din has a right to settle on his own behalf. He can decide, I'm not going to take the thing to court. We're going to settle outside of court. On the other hand, if it's a representative, he doesn't have the right to do that. He's been empowered by the other individual, basically to go get his money. And he doesn't have that option now to make a pshara, to somehow settle with the other party. So you can actually end up with a situation in which settlement is now out of the question. So that's another negative with a harsha. The last thing is that the individual who comes with the harsha feels that that's his job now. His job is to get the money out. So he's going to be much tougher than the individual who himself had come and would make arguments because he was trying to get what he wanted for himself. But here, the individual who has the harsha, his only job or his only reason for being there is to help the other party out. So he's going to be much tougher in order to get the outcome that he wants. For all of those reasons, abab harsha is problematic. All the Rishonim point out that that's only true if he's coming in a situation where it's not beneficial to the other party. And you can see that in the Balei Tosafot. He is a strong man. He's a power man. And he knows how to make claims. He knows how to fast talk. Getting involved in a quarrel, an altercation that's not his. If he is really working on behalf of his friend to get him his money back, because his friend can't do it on his own, or his friend is unable to appear in the court, then mitzvah kalvit. Then he's doing him a favor. So it really has to be clear here why you're involved in this case or what is the motivation for what you're doing. If it benefits the other party, and it really is to his benefit, he would not be able to do this without your help, then your beginning arsha is actually a positive thing, and it's a mitzvah kalvit. On the other hand, if he could have done it on his own, and he just brought you in because you are a difficult guy, or you're a guy who has power, and therefore you're going to shake up this other guy, or the other guy's going to be afraid of you, or he's not going to settle, then that's problematic because your entering into the fray is not beneficial to us coming to an outcome, and actually exacerbates the situation. Other Rishonim just phrase it simply that sometimes when you have parties that are quarreling, it's very hard for them to speak face to face. It's very hard for them to have a conversation in a normal, rational fashion. And therefore you have a mediator that sits between them in order to placate them, to bring the words back and forth, or you broker between them. And sometimes that's helpful. So you have to know the circumstance of the situation, that sometimes it is helpful to have other parties there, because the two litigants wouldn't settle if it was face to face. But if you bring in other parties, the guy going back and forth can cause them to settle. That's why when you have negotiations, you always try to bring in a neutral third party, an arbitrator. But that is to help facilitate. So again, it's a difference between facilitating or causing a problem. If you're facilitating, then that's a mitzvah kavod. If it is, on the other hand, you're exacerbating the situation, that's a person shelo tov asa. Right, so the truth is, in general, the Mishnayot are generally negative towards lawyers. Al tasat smecha korchei adayanim. We have this statement over here, Zeba Baharsha'ah, someone comes with a power of attorney. And the truth is, in yesterday's daf, when we spoke about men and women showing up in court, and the question as to whether you're allowed to have someone represent you in court or not, there the Balei Tosafot said, for a woman it was different between edut and litigation. She could send someone to represent herself there in court if she's a litigant. She can't send someone there to testify on her behalf. The Rif disagree with the Balei Tosafot. But from that statement in the Balei Tosafot, there are other Rishonim who want to argue that therefore you can have what's called an antler, they called it. You can have a lawyer enter on your behalf into a case. You see from here that people are allowed to have representatives in the case. Other Rishonim disagree. And exactly this question about, do we see lawyers as being beneficial to the outcome of cases, or do we see lawyers just making the cases more difficult, less likely to get settled, and more quarreling and altercations going on between the parties? I think that's what the Balei Tosafot are trying to point out. You want it to go in a good direction. So if the person's doing that, then they are beneficial to the case. If they're not doing that, then they're negative to the case. Shmo Amar, Zeh Alukeach Sadeh Sheyesh Aleha Asikim. That's someone who purchases a field that has questions about the ownership. So he buys the field knowing that there are other claimants out there that believe that the field is rightly theirs, and the person selling him the field has questionable title to the field. He doesn't worry about that because he's a strong guy. And he knows that once he gets a hold of this field, nobody's taking it away from him. So he buys a field with questionable title knowing that he'll be able to hold on to it afterwards. That's someone who is not doing the right thing because he's basically shutting down any valid claims with regards to the field. Had it been with the original owner, the people who had claims might have gotten their day in court. They might have had the ability to get their field back. Once ends it up in this buyer's hand, and he's buying it specifically because he knows that once it's in his hands, nobody's going to question it, then he's actually doing something to the detriment of other parties. He's now taking title to something where the title isn't certain, but he's going to make it certain by taking possession of it. And that someone is not doing something good. Right now, we go back to the Mishnah. The Mishnah had a generic statement, which is, Inu Neheget Ele Biru'in Lahayid. It's only Neheg with people who know, have the ability to testify in a case. La Fuke Mai. What is that coming to exclude? in the Mishnah itself already enumerated people who are kasher le'edut, pasul le'edut, men, women, rechokim, krovim. What's left that it's saying here, beruim la'id. Amar papa, lafuke melech, comes to exclude the king. A king, as we know from the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, lo dan velo danin oto, lo me'id velo me'idim oto. He's not involved in the cases of adjudication. He's not subject to the regular court system. And so one of the things that the king is precluded from is coming and testifying in a case. So if he's precluded from testifying in a case, then he's not ra'ui lahaid. He is not appropriate for him to testify in such a case. And therefore, if he takes a shvua denying knowing any testimony, it doesn't have any bearing because his testimony would have had no impact on the case. It comes to exclude someone who is a gambler. So now, the one who says a gambler, then certainly the king. A gambler is only pasul, midirabanan. That's the Mishnah in Sanhedrin that we saw, that those that are disqualified from being a dim, midoraita gazlan is disqualified. But as gazlan is someone who snatches something out of the hand of another party. A gazlan in the sense of misachik bekubia is only a gezel midrabanan. Rashi over here says the problem is asmachta lokanya. That this is the type of kinyan that's not a full-fledged kinyan. Because when you gamble, the person thinks they're going to win and not lose their money. So they never really thought they were going to give up the money in the situation. And then when you take it, you're taking it from someone who didn't really full-heartedly give it to you. Again, there are questions you can see in Rashi, little nuances about this, whether the money was already on the table. That's what the Ramah quotes about. But also Rashi is very interesting over here, because Rashi seems to indicate that the problem in the Mishnah and Sanhedrin is asmach lokanya. And if you look at Rashi on the top of Mem Zayin Amud Aleph also says a similar thing. Asmach lokanya is the problem with Masechek Bekubya. That's against the majority of Rishonim. The majority of Rishonim paskin like Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah in Sanhedrin. The reason why a gambler is pasul eidut is because he's not osek b'yishuvo shel olam. He's not engaged in constructive activity. He's not engaged in things that normal people do. He's making his living by gambling, which is that the person doesn't really understand how real people live and the difficulties of making a living for real people. That's the way that most of the Rishonim paskin. They paskin that asmachta is kanya. But the problem is, mipnei yishuvo shel olam. So it's interesting to note that Rashi, both here and then later on in Daf Mem Zayin Amud Aleph, says that the problem is asmachta lokanya. That is a machloket rishonim, how we pass in that Mishnah. But Rashi taking the position of asmachta lokanya against many of the rishonim, including the Rambam, who says that it is asmachta kanya. The problem is mipnei yishuvo shel olam, that he's not osek b'yishuvo shel olam. In either way, you're only pasul midirabanan. So if a pasul derabanan says that you're not ro'i lahaid, then certainly a pseudo oraita where the king is not allowed to testify because of some tasim alecha melech, that the king has to have a unique standing and you can't degrade the king's position as the king, and that's why he doesn't come in and testify, then certainly there, that psul is already a psul that has anchors de oraita. Mandamar melech, the one who says that it's the king, aval mesachek bekubia midoraita mechsechazi. But then he says the king is disqualified because that's a doraita problem. But misachek kubiyah was only the rabbanon problem. Rabbanon who the pasluah mi doraita is ra'ui la'id. It's only the rabbanon that disqualified him. So this I spoke about in the Mishnah, and I think you also asked about it over here. But this is a very basic hakira which the drashba in the end rejects. The Baal Yad Tosafot frames it in this way, which is that you have two sides over here. Do you look at in shvat eidut the fact that you're able or capable of testifying, is that what determines whether you're considered to be an aid in this situation? And if you take shvat eidut, then you're in trouble. Or does it have to do with your impact on the case, your ability to make a difference in this case? And if you can't make a difference, then you're not an aid. Even though technically you could testify, but since you can't make a difference, it doesn't matter. And that might be the machlokin, and that's the way that the Baal Yad Tosafot over here basically phrased the two opinions, whether a psul derabanan disqualifies you from being chayav in shvat eidut. A psul derabanan basically renders your testimony useless in the case. We're not going to accept your testimony in this case. So if you look at it from an impact standpoint, then that means that there's no shvat eidut because there's no impact. On the other hand, if you look at it simply from the perspective of mina Torah, can you testify? The answer is yes, you're a kosher aid, midoraita. Rabbanan suspended your right to come and testify, but as far as concern of testifying, you could testify, and therefore you might be chayav in shvat eidut. That would be the simplest way to explain the machloket here and make the chakira, is do we focus on your ability to testify, or do we focus on the results or impact of your testimony? The Rashba takes issue with that and says it's obvious that it has to do with impact. If you don't have impact, and we'll see that later in today's daf and further on in the perek, if you can't have impact in the case, you're not considered an aid. Even if you're a kosher aid, you're not an aid if you're not going to make an impact in the case. So now he has a problem. How is he going to explain over here that someone who's posel midrabanan can make an impact in a case? Because now there's somebody who's saying he's going to be chayav in shvuat eidut, and how can you be chayav in shvuat eidut if you can't make an impact? So the Rashba comes up with two answers to that. The first of which is, even though we will not take someone who is a witness who's posel midrabanan and be motzi michavero, nevertheless, tafas lo mafkina milei. The person who is in possession of the item, if we have people that are posel midrabanan, that fact will allow us to keep the money where it is, and we won't demand moving it out. So even though we won't, at that point, take the money back or force it to be moved in the other direction, it still will help you to keep it in the person who's mukzak and tafus in it. That's number one. The second thing he says is, if they show up in court, even if they never testify, you have what happened before, which is that the person might see these individuals showing up in court to testify, and that might cause the litigant to say, uh-oh, there are people going to come here and testify against me, I better tell the truth. So because of that, it might cause somebody to tell the truth, so they could have impact on the case, even though in the end, the court is going to disqualify their testimony. That's a little bit along the lines of the Marish Nekot Yerchak, but you could argue here that they are coming because they have testimony. The court is the one who's going to disqualify them, but that's up to the court. They're coming to do their civic duty and testify. They have something to say. It's not like the Talmud, who had nothing to say, and he's just presenting his face there. They do have something to say, and they're going to tell the truth. They're disqualified because of Psulei Derabanan, but nevertheless, they're not trying to lie, and maybe they're approaching the case, or showing up in the case will have an impact. That's the way the Rashba deals with it. The Turi Evan in Sanhedrin makes a third suggestion, and that is, in a capital case, even though we have these individuals who are Pasumi Derabanan, say for instance in a capital case, you're going to put someone to death. So of course we're not going to listen to these people who are Psulei Derabanan to put someone to death because they're disqualified from being Edim. But what happens if they're on the opposite side of the case? If they're coming to say that this person doesn't deserve death, are we going to then say that Psulei Derabanan disqualifies them from protecting this individual from putting to death? Turi Evan says he doesn't think so. And he thinks that they would actually have impact in the case. So he says you can have Psulei Derabanan have impact in a case where they're matzil, where they're saving the person from being tried in a capital case. So those are ways to avoid what the Bali Tosafot say that the Chakira is about, whether you can testify or the impact of testimony. They say it's all about the impact of testimony, and then they come up with ways that Edei Psulim, Midrabanan, can have impact in cases. Bifnei Beitin, Vishlo Bifnei Beitin. So here we have a machloket between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim in the Mishnah as to whether outside of Beit Din you have the ability to take a shvat ha'idut. So we know that in Beit Din, ben bifnei atzmo, ben bifnei acherim, doesn't matter whether you yourself take the shvat, someone else takes the shvat, it's binding inside of Beit Din and you're chayav for the shvat ha'idut. Outside of Beit Din, there we had a machloket, the Chachamim said there is no case of shvat ha'idut outside of Beit Din. Whereas Rabbi Meir believed that outside of Beit Din, Mipi Atzmo works, Mipi Acherim does not work. With the exception, we saw at the end of the other parak, that if it's Mipi Acherim with Amein, that it does work. So now the Gemara wants to understand, what is the cause for that machloki between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim, that Shvat Eidut Michutz the Beit Din? B'maika Miflegei, what are they arguing about? Amru Rabbanan Kameid Rapapa, so Rabbanan suggested to Rapapa, B'don Mina U'mina, B'don Mina Vuki Be'atra Kamiflegei. So a fundamental machloket, when we have a gzeres shava, how does the gzeres shava function? Over here we have a gzeres shava of techeta, from shvat ha-pikadon. Next perek, shvat ha-pikadon is also found at the end of Parshat Vayikra, a case where a person denies under oath owing money, and then afterwards admits to the fact that he owes money. He has to bring a korban for shvat ha-pikadon. That's shvat ha-pikadon, and what we have here, shvat ha-edut, are both korbanot that are brought b'mezid, meaning that when the person violated something intentionally. So they have a commonality between them. And there's also gzer shava of techeta, that gzer shava now teaches us about the dinim. Now, when it comes to Shvuat Eidut, it says in the pasuk v'shama kol ala, that he heard somebody taking a shvuah. That is indicative of the fact that the shvuah is being imposed on him by others. Someone else is taking the shvuah, and then that's being imposed on the individual over here. Number two is v'im lo yagid v'nasa avuno. The Gemara is going to darshin that b'makom hagadah, only in the place where hagadah is relevant, is the shvuat eidut relevant. So those two things teach you that the case in the Torah for shvuat eidut is number one, a case where it's shvuah mipi acherim, and number two, it's in court. So that's all you know. When you read the psukim by shvuat eidut, the only thing you know is mipi acherim, in court, you're going to be obligated for shvuat eidut. When it comes to shvuat hapikadon, there's no demand for being done in court, number one. Number two is the pasuk, if you read the psukim by shvuat hapikadon, it sounds like the individual himself took the false shvuah. He denied owing the money under oath. And so it was a self-initiated shvuah, or what's called mipi atzmo. So by shvuah tapikadon, the classic shvuah that is there is mipi atzmo. Doesn't matter whether it's in court or outside of court. Now I have a gzer shavav techeta, which teaches me that not only by shvuah ta'idut is mipi acherim shvuah ta'idut, even mipi atzmo is also considered to be shvuat eidut. I'm learning that from shvuat hapikadon that has mipi atzmo, and I'm teaching about shvuat eidut that it also is subject to mipi atzmo. Now, the machloket here is when you have such a gzer shava, how does it work? Do I take the limud from shvuat hapikadon, bring it over to the world of shvuat eidut, and the world of shvuat eidut in court is relevant, out of court is irrelevant? And so now when I bring in mipi atzmo, it's only going to be relevant in court. And that means the limud, and that's the Chachamim's view, you're going to take the limud from shvuat hapikadon about mipi atzmo and say that just like mipi acherim in court is chayav shvuat eidut, so to mipi atzmo in court is chayav for shvuat eidut. Or you could say that, well, the source for this is shvuat hapikadon, and I'm learning the zer shava from shvuat hapikadon, and in because shvuat hapikadon, mipi atzmo works both in court and out of court. So if I'm bringing that limud over to shvuat eidut, I'm going to bring the whole thing over from shvuat hapikadon. And just like by shvuat hapikadon, mipi atzmo works both in and out of court, now when I have it in shvuat eidut, it's also going to work both in court and out of court. And that'll be the view of Rabbi Meir, which is that we're going to take the limud from shvuat hapikadon, not just the piatzmo, but everything, all the trappings that come with it are going to be brought with it. So that's what the Rabbanan are suggesting to Rapapa, is the machoket. Meir Savar Domina Umina Pikadon. You learn from Shvata Pikadon and you take all the trappings of Shvata Pikadon. Ma Pikadon Mushba Mipiatzmo Chayav. Just like by Shvata Pikadon, Mipiatzmo is the classic Shvua. Af Eidut Mushba Mipiatzmo Chayav. So too by Shvata Eidut, Mipiatzmo is also going to be Chayav. Umina. And from Shvata Pikadon, you're going to take the trappings. Ma Pikadon Ben Bebeitin Ben Shalo Beitin. Whether you're in or out of Beit Din, there's no qualification of that by Shvuat HaPikadon. Avedut ben beBeit Din ben shelo beBeit Din. Whether it's in Beit Din or not in Beit Din, you're going to be chayav Shvuat HaEidut. Rabbanan savrei, Rabbanan believe, domina v'uke ba'atro. That you learn it from Shvuat HaPikadon, but then you give it the trappings of Shvuat HaEidut. Ma Pikadon mushpa mipnei atzmo chayav. Just like by Pikadon, when he takes the shvuah of his own volition, he is chayav. Avedut mushpa mipnei atzmo chayav. So too by shvuat eidut, mipnei atzmo will be chayav. V'uki ba'atra, then you give it the shape of shvuat eidut. Ma mushpa mipnei acherim bebeitin, in shelo bebeitin lo. When it comes to shvuat eidut, when it's mipnei acherim, we said it has to be makom hagadah. Only in the place where testimony is accepted, only in court is it relevant. It's not relevant outside of court. Af mushba mipi atzmo. So too now when we bring in mushba mipi atzmo to work by shvuat eidut, it'll have that same restriction or qualification. Bebeitin in, shabil bebeitin lo. In beitin it is valid, outside of beitin it is not valid. Now we'll explain the machloket between them. Amar lo rapapa. Imi pikadon gamri la rabbonon. Tukuli ama lo plige de domina umina. Rapapa rejects this view of the rabbonon who are presenting to him, and say that if it was true that we were learning it out of the Gzer Shavra from Pikadon, then the Rabbanan would agree with Rabbi Meir's position, and everybody would hold Domina Umina. You learn it out fully from Shvuat HaPikadon. Elahainu Taimid the Rabbanan. This is the reasoning behind the Rabbanan's position. The Maiti La B'Kal V'Chomer. They learn it out of a kal v'chomer. Uma mi pi acherim chayav, mi pi atzmo lo kol shekein. First of all, you don't need to learn it from shvuat ha-pikadon. If a person is held responsible for a shvuah taken by someone else, then certainly he should be held accountable for a shvuah that he takes himself. That should be obvious. If you articulate it yourself, you should be in a much better position than if it's articulated by someone else. And then, whether you answered amen or didn't answer amen, that's questionable. We'll have to deal with that in a second. But it certainly should be that you're chayav. Why do you need to go to shvuat ha-pikadon to learn that? If mi pi acherim works, then certainly pi atzmo works. And now they learn how to have a kavachomer. A kavachomer can only learn from the originating object and then bring it into the new object. The originating object is mipi acherim, and mipi acherim is limited to inside of beitin. So now if you're going to say a kavachomer that says certainly mipi atzmo is going to be chayav, it'll have the same qualifications as mipi acherim, which is only in beitin is it valid. Outside of a beitin, it's not valid. When you use a logical argument of a kal v'chomer that says this is more chamur, so certainly it will work, you can't beat the chamur thing more than the item you're learning for. A kal v'chomer lets you learn at the same level of the originating item. It doesn't allow you to exceed what the originating item had. The originating item is limited to in beitin. So if that's the case, then so too when you exercise the kal v'chomer, mipi atzmo will be limited to in beitin. And Tosafot says, and we can't learn it in Memei Matzinu, and say, oh, Mei Matzinu from Shvuat HaPikadon that we see that Mei Pi Atzmo applies in both places, so too over here, because there's a Chumrah in Shvuat HaPikadon. And that is that Shvuat HaPikadon applies to men and women, whereas Shvuat HaEidud only applies to men. So there is a problem there that would not allow you to learn by Mei Matzinu from Pikadon, and that would leave you bound by this Kal V'Chomer that you could only have Dayol Avodidin and Liot Kenidon. Amr le Rabbanu le Rapapa, mi amatzit amart, dela bedo mina umina plige. Can you really say what you're saying? You basically dismissed our explanation of the machloket and said that's not what they're arguing about. But rather, they're arguing about a kal v'chomer versus a gzeira shava. Is that really true? That's not. Problem is the upcoming Mishnah with regards to shvat ha-pikadon, which is kavei pikadon, it says, shvat ha-pikadon, yohaged banashim ubenashim, berechokim ubikrovim, bikshirim ubipsulim, bifne beitin, shalo bifne beitin, mipi atzmo. So here you have, everything is chayav here. Men, women, relatives, non-relatives, before beitin, shalo before beitin, kshirim lehayit, shalo kshirim lehayit, everything is chayav, mipi chayirim. Enu chayav achikfor bo bebeitin, divrei Rabbi Meir. Rechamim armim, ben mipi atzmo, ben mipi acherim, kevin shekafar bo chayav. Whether it's mipi atzmo mipi acherim, once he denies it, he's chayav. Mushba mipi acherim bepikadon minalo hodo rabbanon de chayav. According to you, how do the rabbanon know that a pikadon has any manifestation of mipi acherim? So here there's a machloket Rabbi Meir chachamim there as well. But Rabbi Meir, we understand how he knows that shvat ha-pikadon has mipi acherim, he has the gzer shava of techeta techeta. So it's bidirectional. So he knows by shvat ha-edut mipi atzmo from shvat ha-pikadon. By shvat ha-pikadon, he knows about mipi acherim from shvat ha-edut. But the chachamim learned mipi acherim from a kal v'chomer internally in shvat ha-edut. Then how do they ever have a case of mipi acherim in shvat ha-pikadon? That's not a kal v'chomer. Just because you're chayam mipi atzmo doesn't mean you should be chayam mipi acherim. Elalav the gamrila meidut. It must be that they learned it out from the gzeir shava of techeta techeda. Ishma mina bedom mina mina plige. If that's the case, then they both agree about the gzeir shava, and their disagreement is about how you apply the gzeir shava. Do you learn it out from shvat ha-pikadon just mipi atzmo, or do you also learn out all the trappings that it applies both in and out of court? And therefore, the talmidim were right about that. For Papa responds to them, mehayin meha lekanamash mina. He says, from that Mishnah by Shvat HaPikadon, you are right. From our Mishnah over here, you are incorrect. He said, you are medayeket of our Mishnah. From our Mishnah, you cannot prove that the machloket is about domina, umina, or domina voki be'atra, because you could explain the Mishnah the way I did, which is it's a kal v'chomer. Once you reach the Mishnah by Shvat HaPikadon, enochanami, you're right, because over there, there's no way for the chachamim to learn it except through gzeir shava, and therefore it would have to be the machloket. So what Rav Papa is just pointing out to them is you're not wrong in your explanation of their machloket, you're wrong in the way that you concluded that and the way that you came to that logical understanding. You'd medayek it of our Mishnah, that's just not true. If you're medayek it of Shvuat HaPikadon, I agree with you, and that is correct. And so it's a methodological teaching that Rav Papa is giving them, which is, you can be right, but you can arrive at the right answer through the wrong way. And that's what they did. They arrived at it the wrong way, and he's just showing them that that's wrong. You have to come to it through a different angle. V'chayavin al zdon ha-shvua. You are chayav on zdon ha-shvua. Menachan emile. How do you know that when you do something intentionally, that's why you're chayav? D'tarabanan, b'kulam ne'amar behen v'ne'alam. As we discussed yesterday, there are three items that are subject to korban ole v'yorei. Shvat ha'idut, shvat bitoy, and yidiyat ha-tumah. By yidiyot ha-tumah, and by shvat bitoy, it says v'ne'alam, that you forgot. Forgetting is shkaga, unintentional. V'kam lo ne'amar ba v'ne'alam. By shvat ha'idut, the word ne'alam never appears. L'chayev el-amezid kishogeg, to tell you that intentional violation will subject you to this punishment just like a shogeg. V'al-shigegata imzdon ha'idut, and if he does it unintentionally, but he knows he's doing something wrong, but there is some shogeg in the case, heichidami shigegata imzdon ha'idut. If you know testimony, and you know that you're lying and denying that testimony, where is the shogeg over here? Samer Yehuda Marav, Omer Yehuda Ani Sheshvua Zu Asura. I know that this shvua is problematic. Am I uncertain as to whether you're chayav a korban for it or you're not chayav from a korban? The other way that we explained in the Mishnah, which is the other possibility, is he knows that what he's doing is wrong, but he just doesn't know that it's wrong to take a shvua to that effect. So you could take it a step back and also make the shkaga in the shvua itself. But nevertheless, you have to have zdon ha'idut, which is you have to know that your denial of knowing testimony is the problem over here, and you have to know that you know testimony and you're denying it is wrong. Ve'en chayavin al shigigata gredita. So, you know now that this word does not appear in the Mishnah, because this word is Aramaic. And Aramaic does not appear in the Mishnah. So when the Gemara here quotes the Mishnah saying, ve'en shigigata gredita, that word, you go back to the Mishnah, doesn't appear there. But it is what is implied in the Mishnah, which is that you're not chayav a korban olev yoreid for a shigigah. That's what the Mishnah says. Rashi over there claims that's a shigigah gredita. That's just a plain and simple shkagah. The plain and simple shkagah that Rashi explained over there is in a case where the guy forgot that he knew the testimony. He took a shvat ha'idut, thinking that he had no testimony to give. Later on, he remembers that he does have testimony to give. That's your case of shkagaga gredita. You should know that the Rambam and others disagree with Rashi's view over there. If it's a case where he doesn't remember about the edut at all, then it's clear that's a shkagah. The Mishnah doesn't need to tell you that. That's almost like a case of anus. He didn't remember that he has edut. So when he takes a shvua, of course he's not going to be held accountable for that. So they come up with scenarios, for instance, where he has a safek. He's not certain if he remembers edut or not, and then he takes the shvua despite being uncertain. That's called a shkagah for those other rishonim. And then the word gredita would not be appropriate. So it seems that the word gredita here was added in based on Rashi's explanation of the Mishnah. Lema tanina laha did Rav Kahana v'Ravasi. So let us say now that we have a Mishnah that corroborates what happened with Rav Kahana and Ravasi. If you remember, they were the two Talmidim that sat before Rav, and they're arguing about what Rav said. Each one of them took a shvua saying, shvua, that this is what Rav said. They both took a shvat abitui, saying that this is what Rav said, and obviously they had opposing positions, and then one of them was found to be right when they approached Rav. So the other one said to Rav, did I just take a shvat sheker? Rav answered them, no, libcha anascha, that you were thinking that you were telling the truth when you took the shvua, and therefore that's not even considered to be a shogeg, you're an anus. If you're an anus, you're not chayav in a korban. So what the Gemara is now suggesting is our Mishnah corroborates that. Because our Mishnah is now telling you exactly what Rav told his Talmidim, which is if you don't remember the Eidut, and then you take a Shvat Eidut, you're not Chayav, because you didn't remember at the time of Shvua. Lo, Afagav Ditznan, even though you have a Mishnah, Itzrich, you still need what Rav told the Talmidim. Sakadat Chamina Hochohu Deloktei V'Ne'alam. Over here, in our case of Shvat Eidut, the Torah never uses the word Ne'alam of Shkaga. Tebeinan Shogeg Dumya Demezid. And therefore you need the shkagah, the unintentional, to be similar to the intentional. Over there where it says, if you forget, maybe you would think that any type of shkagah would make you liable. That's not the case. So over here, where there's no mention of shkagah at all, then any form of shkagah will give you the dispensation, which is similar to mezid. As long as it's not mezid, it's classified as shkagah. So no matter what you classify it is, as long as you say it's not intentional, you're off the hook. In the case of minelam by shvata bitui, there's a demand for shkagah. And if you qualify as a shkagah, then you're going to be chayav. So now, where does this situation where you forget and take a shva after you've forgotten, where does it sit? It probably sits somewhere on the line between shkagah and anus. So in the case of shvata edut, it's clear it's out of the picture because it's not intentional. But for minelam, it's right on that borderline between shogeg and anus. And I don't know, is it included or not included? And that's what Rav comes to teach us. It's anus and not shkagah. Right now we move on to the next Mishnah. Shvat Eidut Ketzad. Give us an example. Show us how Shvat Eidut works. Amar Lishnaim Bove Duni. Person says to two people, come and testify on my behalf. Shva Sheinan Dunin Yodim Lecha Eidut. We take a shva that we don't know any testimony for you. Oh, Shamrulo, Sheinan Dunin Yodim Lecha Eidut. We don't know any testimony for you. Mashbiani Aleichem. He says, I'm taking a shvua to that effect. V'amru, amen. And they answer, amen. Harelu chayavin. They are culpable in that case for shvuat ha'edut. So here, the question is, where is this taking place? Is this taking place in Beit Din, or is this taking place out of Beit Din? If it's taking place in Beit Din, then it is the shita of the chachamim, because the chachamim agree that in Beit Din, mipi atzmo, and mipi acherim works. So then you could explain the Mishnah even according to the Chachamim. But the problem is, why do they need to answer Amen? Amen is only necessary outside of Beit Din for Rabbi Meir, because otherwise we would not consider it to be a Shvua. But in Beit Din, where Mipi Acherim works, you do not need to answer Amen. So why, if you say that it's authored by the Chachamim, is the Amen necessary? So Rashi says, Ve'amru Amen Chayavin. Avalim Shatku, Achara Shvua, Ein Kan Kabbalat Shvua. If they were silent after the Shvua, there is no Kabbalat HaShvua. Rashi over here says, Shtika does not work when you have a Shvua Mipi Acherim. And therefore, they have to answer Amen in Beit Din. This is very difficult given the Gemara at the end of the last Perek, where the last Perek spoke about Mipi Acherim without an Amen, and Mipi Acherim with an Amen. Gemara only made that distinction outside of Beit Din. Inside of Beit Din, the Gemara never made such a distinction. And so, where does Rashi come up with this idea that shtika is considered not to be hodah and not considered to be a shvua? Now what Rashi in essence is saying is, you can't say that someone has taken a shvua without any active engagement. If someone else takes a shvua and says, Mashbiani Aleichem, why is that binding on you? Where does it make it binding? The answer could be context. You're in court right now, and you're denying testimony in court, a place where you should be testifying and giving testimony, and therefore the context may be what creates that binding. And that is one way that you could deal with it and suggest that it does work. But Rashi is unwilling to have that and says you just can't have a Kabbalat Shvua without an Amen or without some response. And that out of response, you're not going to have it, and that's why you have to answer Amen over here. So now you could argue that it's Amen Lav Davka, and therefore, maybe there's a difference between answering Amen and affirming. If they simply affirmed it, that would have been enough. Amen makes it as if they said the Shvua themselves. So maybe that's what the Mishnah is after, and that might be another way to deal with Rashi. And you can see that in the Balei HaTosafot, where he says, Inami, Ati afilu k'rabbanan v'nakad v'amru Amen k'dei lekatzer. That's just a fill-in. V'hu adin amru achar kach inan yudim l'chayidut. That it just has to be that they do a kfira, or they do something that in some way affirms the Shvua, but it doesn't have to be Amen. So that could be the way to explain it. On the other hand, other Rishonim, including the Balei HaTosafot and the Ramban, come up with different solutions to the problem. The Ramban says that it happened outside of Beit Din, and that's why you needed an Amen here, because inside of Beit Din, an Amen is not necessary. The Ramban says that Shtika Kehoda, and Shtika Kehoda, when you're Mushba Mipi Acherim, inside of Beit Din is binding on the Edim, and so therefore it must be speaking outside of Beit Din, and that's why you need an Amen over here. And you can see that in the Balei HaTosafot, Aliba de Rabbi Meir, Ati, de Chayev, Chutz, le Beit Din, b'mushpa mipi atzmo, ulekach yitzrich lemitnei, v'amru amein, davi kimotzi shvua mipiv. So that's why you need the amein over here, because it makes the kimotzi mishvua mipiv, therefore it's following the shita of Rabbi Meir, and you need the amein to switch the mipi acherim to a mipi atzmo. So this goes back to your question, which is, what does it mean, lashbia mipi acherim? And here you have a fundamental machloket. Lashbia mipi acherim, according to the Balei Tosafot, according to the Ramban, does not require an amen, and therefore both of them explain it as being outside of Beit Din and not in Beit Din, because if you were in Beit Din, you wouldn't need amen. Rashi, on the other hand, says that anything mipi acherim requires at least some affirmation or an amen. So it is a machloket how mipi acherim works. Is mipi acherim simply, if you're in Beit Din and somebody says, mashbiani aleichem, and you do not respond, you are bound by that shvua? Or do you need to answer affirmatively in order for that to be binding? Rashi says you need to answer. The Rishonim, like the Balei Tosafot and the Ramban, think that that's not the case. You only need to answer out of court to make it as if it's mipi atzmo. But in court, mipi acherim would be binding on you, even without any affirmation. It would be a shtika kehoda. All right, so now the Mishnah moves on. He forced them to take a shvua outside of Beit Din 5 times. He keeps asking them for testimony, and they deny the testimony. It says, take a shvua to that effect. And they take a shvua 5 times. They show up in Beit Din, behodu. And then they say, we do have testimony. Piturim. They are patur in this case, because the shvuaot that they took outside of Beit Din were not binding on them. Kafru. If they come to Beit Din and then deny having testimony, and then they're found to have that testimony, chayavin al kol achat v'achat, then they're responsible for every shvua that they took beforehand. So here you have a case where they take multiple shvuot outside of Beit Din, show up in Beit Din and admit that they have testimony. In that case, no chiyuv, because they never denied in Beit Din having testimony. That then, if they come to Beit Din and then deny testimony, then they're going to be held liable not only for denying the testimony in Beit Din, but for every shvua they took even outside of Beit Din. And the Balei Tosafot note over here, even though this latter half of the Mishnah sounds like Rabbi Meir, because it's Michutz the Beit Din, you are Chayav, nevertheless, it can even follow the position of the Chachamim, because the Chachamim don't require that the shvua be in Beit Din, they just require that the Kfira be in Beit Din. And over here you have that, you have the Kfira in Beit Din, and therefore this could even be according to the Shita of the Chachamim. On the other hand, if in Beit Din he asked them 5 times, do you have testimony? They deny it. And each time he says, Hishbiani aleichem, I am imposing a shvua on you, v'kafru, and they deny it. Einan chayavin elachat. In that case, they're only chayav for 1 violation. Amar Rabbi Shimon matam. It seems almost backwards. In Beit Din, where that's the main area of shvua deidut, you're only going to chayav 1 for the denial and multiple shvuot. Outside of Beit Din, where that's not the main context or the main forum for shvua deidut, you're going to be chayav on every one of the shvuot. Why is that? Because they can't go back and change their mind. Inside of Beit Din, when you make a denial of knowing testimony, you're then bound, as Rashi says, by Kevin Sheigid, Shuvenu Chuzer Umagid. Once a witness has come and given testimony, he's no longer able to come now and give alternate testimony. So if you deny knowing something in Beit Din, after that you can't change your mind. So when you took the first shvua, affirming the fact that you do not know testimony, you're going to be chayav from that. Every other shvua after that is not shvua te'edut, because you're no longer ra'oi to be an aid after that point in time. If you come and testify to the fact that you do know eidut, we're not going to believe you. We're not going to accept you. So every subsequent shvua is not binding on him, and he will not be chayav for shvuat ha'eidut. It might even be a shvuat shav, because he's taking a shvua about something that he can't take a shvua about. That might relate to the ritva in the previous parak, whether when you're affirming something you already took a shvua, that's deemed to be a shvuat shav, or simply just an additional shvuat bitui. On the other hand, if you swear outside of Beit Din, your denial of testimony outside of Beit Din is not binding on you. You're not considered an aid outside of Beit Din. And that means that if you deny testimony outside of Beit Din and then come to Beit Din and say we do have testimony, then you can testify. It's only your denial inside of Beit Din that prevents you from then going ahead and changing your mind. So in that scenario, every time you took a shvua outside of Beit Din, it was binding on you. Because every time you took a shvua on that denial, the next time he comes and asks you about testimony, you could have changed your mind and given testimony. The fact that you deny it again is a new denial. Each new denial subjects you to a new shvua te'idut. Now, that will only be binding, or you will only be subject to those penalties once you come to Beit Din and deny testimony in Beit Din. If you come to Beit Din right away and admit that you have testimony, then that's not going to be a problem with what they do, because when you came to the context of court and the forum of court, you testified. But if you come to court and deny it, then retroactively you're going to be chayav for all those other denials, because each one of those denials was meaningful. Because in each of those cases, after you denied it, you're going to come back and give in testimony. So that's the way that Rashi explains it. On the other hand, the Ran, Al-Arif here, he gives a slightly different approach to it, but it's similar in nature, which is, in Beit Din, when he testifies and takes a shvuah, if after that he admits that he has testimony, he's a Rasha. Because he is denied it under oath in Beit Din, and now when he changes his mind, he's deemed a Rasha. And so then every subsequent shvuah he took was an invalid shvuah because he was a Rasha. And for that reason, he will not be chayav for the shvuot. Although the Ritva comes up with scenarios where we could then say that they are not deemed to be Rishayim over here. And the problem here is, Kevin Shigid, Shuvenu Chuzer Magid, because either we would be Pagin and Dibura, or they can make a claim that they forgot originally, and that's why they made the denial, and so therefore they're not deemed to be Rishayim. Alright. Kafru, Shneem Gechad. If you have two Edim that come simultaneously, Tochadei Dibur, and deny testimony, Shneem Chayavim. They're both chayav for shvuat ha'edut. B'zeh hazeh, if they come successively to do that, harishon chayav, hasheni patur. The first one is chayav, the second one is patur. Because once the first one denied testimony, the second aid becomes valueless at this point. And this goes back to what the Rashba said. The Rashba says, you see in the Mishnah here, test your validity as an aid, not whether you know testimony, whether you can testify. It's a question of impact. It's whether you're effective as an aid. Once you've eliminated the first aid of the kat, then your aidut now is deemed invalid because you're a single aid. And since now you're a single aid, you're going to be patur for shvuat aidut. Kofar achad vodechad. If one of the witnesses denies he has testimony, the other one admits he has testimony, akufer chayav. The one who denied it is chayav because now the denying party is affecting the ability to testify. The one who admitted he had testimony is now a valid aid. The other guy would have been a valid aid had he not denied it. So his denial now is ruining the ability to testify in the case. Hayu shtei kitei edim. You have two sets of edim. Kafra rishona, vachaka kafra shnia. The first one denies knowing testimony, then the second one denies knowing testimony. Shtehem chayavot. Both of them are responsible. Mipnei sheedut, yuchola lehitkayem b'shtehem. Because both parties could have been the edut that would have been impactful in this situation. Meaning that the first edim denied testifying, now the second edim could have testified and been impactful in the case. Had the first edim testified, then the second set of edim, they weren't necessarily impactful in the case. If they make a denial afterwards, they wouldn't necessarily be chayav. Then only if the first ones got disqualified would they be chayav for that denial. But if the first ones are valid and then they deny it, they wouldn't have been impactful in the case anyway. But here, where they're both denying it, they both sets would have been impactful had they testified truthfully, and therefore both are going to be held accountable for shvuat ha'edut. Amar Shuel, Ra'u sheratz achareihem. They see him running after him. Amru lo ma'ata ratz achareinu. Why are you running after us? Shvuah she'inanu yudim l'cha'edut. They take a shvuah, we don't know any testimony for you. Paturim. They are patur. Why? Ad she'ishma mipiv. Until they hear the claim or the asking for testimony from the claimant. The toveya has to ask them for testimony, and they have to deny his request. If they voluntarily deny the request, then that is not considered to be shvuat ha'edut. Where it says, Maikamash Malan, what's more teaching us? Tanina, it's the Mishnah. Shilach b'yad abdo, o shamar lehen anitba, majbiani aleichem. If he sent his eved to ask them for testimony, or the defendant in the case asked for the testimony. Mashbiani aleichem, shimatem yodim lo edut, shetavoh v'teyudu, harelu pturim, ad shiishmu mipi ha-toveya, until they hear it directly from the mouth of the toveya. The answer of the Gemara is, ratz achreihem, it's trichalei. The fact that he's running after them, that's what we needed over here. Sal kadat cho amina, kegev ander ratz achreihem, kemandamar lo udomi. That fact that he's running after them, sometimes the people can speak, not through words, but through actions. And so maybe over here, he's speaking to them by running after them. That's the equivalent of him basically asking them for testimony. Shmuel comes along to say, Kamash Malan, that that's not the case. unless he articulates the demand for testimony, they're not going to be chayav for shvuat eidut. That is, he has to request it from them, and then they have to deny it under oath. That is what's going to make them chayav for shvuat eidut. Okay, we're going to stop here, 3 lines down on the top of Lamed Bet, Amud Aleph.